Good afternoon, counsel. May it please the court. My name is James Geddes. I'm here on behalf of the applicant. The appellant, petitioner below. Today we have a case that I believe is one of first impression, and I think it brings two issues before this court that the court has not had an opportunity to write on. The first being whether an expectancy is a property right under 1513 of the Delaware Code. The second one is whether post-separation contributions by a participant in a retirement plan can be deemed marital property under the same statute. On the most recent decision by Justice Jacobs in Forrester versus Forrester for the panel on Bonk, I don't believe reaches either one of those issues, and we will discuss that in a minute. With regard to the facts, I think the facts are pretty simple in the sense of what the context of this issue is. Mr. Fannin has worked for a long time for a local bank. He is a participant in a pension plan, and he also is a participant in a supplemental retirement benefit plan referred to as a SERP. At the time of the divorce of the petitioner and respondent, petitioner was not vested in the SERP, nor did he have any property interest in the SERP, because under the terms of that plan, the board of directors could at any time modify it, change it, or eliminate it. Also, he had to qualify each year for participation in it. So in any particular year, the board of directors could say, you are no longer a participant. Therefore, we do not contend, or we do contend, that it is not a property interest which is subject to division.
Well, why isn't that accounted for by the, is there a way people pronounce this, the QDRO, or do they just spell it out? In family court.
QDRO.
All right. Why isn't that accounted for by that on the if, as, and when condition for the award?
Because QDRO only applies to pensions, either contingent or vested. This is not a pension. This is a plan. This is supplemental income. A pension plan is based on the concept of deferred compensation, i.e., the employer makes a bargain with the employee that we will contribute to this plan as long as you defer compensation. You become eligible for that plan when you first start to work. It's a commitment. It's a contract. You then get vested after some period of time, and that deferred compensation is based on those layers, if you will, building blocks throughout that career. That is not what we have here.
But if the plan has in its formula years of employment during the marriage, isn't that pulling that foundation into the calculation?
But there was no promise. There's no hook. There's no reason to claw back because there's nothing there. It's an expectancy. It is not a right. It's not a property right. The statute's very clear. It has to be a property right. This is not a right. Mr. Fannin does not have the right today, next week, next month, next year to go to the board of directors and say, I'm entitled to some benefit. It's the same as if I offered you an insurance policy on my life for $100,000 and said to you, but you have to be 62 and a half. And you reach 62 and a half. That makes you entitled to be the beneficiary, but it doesn't mean that you're entitled to that policy as long as I'm alive, because I can change the beneficiary.
All right. So you're, one of your contentions is that the court could not divide up whatever rights there were in that expectancy, as you call it, because there was no property right. That is, the wife had no property right in the SERP,
or
since it wasn't vested.
Or the husband.
Or the husband.
Has nothing to do with vesting. Has to do with the fact that it's an expectancy. There is no enforceable right. If you go back to
at some point there will be an enforceable right.
Maybe.
At some point.
But it goes back to the Brown decision. If I just follow up, Your Honor, on the Brown decision, which with Justice Duffy relied on in Roberts versus Barbara, and which you also cited in Forrester. And that clearly, in the Brown decision, when they applied the marital property or community property to a non-vested pension, they made the distinction between an expectancy and a pension right, which they concluded was a property right.
Suppose, just to follow up, suppose a husband bought a lottery ticket you know, the chances of anyone winning the lottery ticket are pretty small. I gather that would be an expectancy also. Is it your position that upon the dissolution of a marriage that the family court could not award the wife some percentage of the proceeds of that lottery if and when the husband had good fortune and won the lottery?
I think it's distinguishable. It is a contingent.
So the court could do that.
The court could take that document or that chance, if you will, piece of paper, which may sometime in the future have value, and argue that if it wins, he has that right to it.
The court could so hold.
The court could so hold, but here there is no right, because
why is the lottery ticket a right but not the prospect of enjoying the proceeds of the SERP?
Because it can be changed at any time, similar to the Social Security analysis that you used in Forrester versus Forrester. It can be changed. Like Congress can change Social Security, it's not a vested right. And you made the distinction there clearly in that analysis that the pension that was subject to review, the police pension, even though it was in lieu of Social Security, was still a contractual right. But like Social Security, this is not that type of right. It's only an expectancy. And this court, in sort of an analogous case, in Simons versus Coggan, which involved a convertible debenture, stated that there were no fiduciary rights to the owner of that convertible debenture until it was actually transferred or exchanged into stock. That all that owner had was an expectancy interest. And what we're saying here is an expectancy interest is not subject to division under 1513. And if you follow the progeny of Brown through Roberts and Barbara, and also through the court's most recent case in July, you can see that distinction is made time and time again. We are not talking about a pension, and the contingencies with regard to the pension are not the issue. The issue here is that it is completely discretionary, and that the petitioner and the respondent have no property right to this supplemental income.
So if a pension plan said contingent upon funds being available or something, some contingency like that into the plan itself, would that turn it into an expectancy?
No, because there's a contractual right there. There's a contractual right to the extent that those funds exist, that you're entitled to those monies. I mean, that's the difference. Because the pension is, it has been concluded by this court and others, is a contractual obligation. And therefore, that is completely different than this supplemental retirement, which is a maybe. It is a revocable promise sometime in the future.
But doesn't it become a contractual obligation upon certain contingencies?
Yes, those contingencies being, one, age of 55, two, that the board has continued to nominate this individual as a participant, and three, that the plan exists.
Well, if you have a contract with contingencies that's going to create a property right, why can't that be divided?
Because it's not a contract. He has nothing that's enforceable. If you go back to the definition of expectancy in Brown, which this court has relied on, it's basically where the person who is a recipient of the benefit does not have the right to enforce it. The petitioner in this case has no rights to this supplemental income benefit. It is an incentive to try to keep him employed or at least continue his employment at the local bank. It comes from a completely different aspect. Instead of being deferred compensation, which he has earned during the marriage, it is coming in on top saying, please do not leave us. If you stay here, we will give you these additional funds, assuming the conditions we just discussed.
So your definition of a property right is something that is enforceable legally?
Yes.
And if it isn't, then it's not a property right.
Well, it's not enforceable. Yes, correct. It is an expectancy because you have no, if you have the right to enforce it, then it is a right that I think probably relates to property. But in this case, the petitioner has no right to enforce this. And he cannot do anything if the bank decides, and in my example, if I say, well, you're my beneficiary if you reach 62 and a half, and then when you reach 62 and a half, I say, well, sorry, I'm going to go make Susie over here my beneficiary, there's nothing that the first beneficiary can do about that. That's what makes it an expectancy. That's what makes it different than a property right. And I don't think that this court certainly has addressed that issue before. You have not addressed a plan that is underfunded, not defined, or qualified. And as I've said before, I believe it is analogous to the court's discussion about the difference between the police pension and Social Security in the fact that the bank, like Congress, can make any amendments to this that it wants.
Well, in this case, have you quantified the amount of money that's at issue? I recognize you have to state a retirement age and your employer has to not eliminate you from the plan, but I'm just assuming, since you've taken an appeal to the Delaware Supreme Court, someone's thought about the amount of money at issue.
The amount of money at issue is purely theoretical.
All right, give me the theory.
The theory is that at some point in time...
Not the theory, the theoretical amount.
It is presumably 60% of whatever his monthly income is at the time that he is eligible for retirement times the factor times her entitlement. So there's money. It's serious money. I'm not going to suggest that it isn't if all of those things occur.
So it's a heads I win, tails you lose situation as far as the husband is concerned.
I'm not sure I understand the heads and tails.
Well, that if at the time of the property division you don't have an enforceable right, but it may become enforceable in the future, then the wife loses, but the husband may win at some point in the future when all of the contingencies come to pass.
He may, or he may not.
But the wife certainly will not, will never.
She
gets only the downside, but not the upside. But the husband gets the risk of the downside and the benefit of the upside.
But she's only entitled what is defined in the statute, 1513, as property. This is not property.
So you contend.
So I contend. And the second issue goes, if the court wants to affirm the lower court, this court has to make another analysis. Not only do you have to find an expectancy, a property interest under the statute, you also now have to say that his subsequent efforts in order to be entitled to this SERP, the last 5 years before his retirement, all of which will occur after the marriage, is contribution by a participant that is subject to marital division. Now, there is no case in this jurisdiction that has said that. The closest we have come are some family court cases, the Shields case.
I'm sorry, you've lost me.
Sorry.
What's the legal foundation for the argument? You know, what I wrote down was that we have to say that his subsequent efforts are a contribution, and at that point...
a contribution that is post-separation, i.e., he is making efforts that are occurring after the marriage, that are not tied to any pre-marriage pension or deferred compensation. This is all new effort that is going to occur that on which this potential expectancy may be based.
But isn't that recognized in the formula for dividing the right, whatever it might be?
No, because the multiplier is that 5 years of future effort. This court has only said that post-separation changes that relate to economics, such as COLAs, cost of living increases, things that the participant is not contributing, i.e. money or time or effort, yes, the parties are entitled to divide that. But as the cases that we stated, cited from Idaho, Texas, Kentucky, all say that there should be an attempt to separate out that post-separation contribution.
Have we rejected the marital foundation theory expressly?
I'm not sure what you mean, Your Honor, by marital foundation.
Well, don't the cases that go the other way say that the foundation is based upon the marriage that enabled the spouse to acquire that future interest?
Yes, it's the foundation block, which I talked about before, like deferred compensation. Those obligations occur, the promise, the commitment, the contract, occur during the marriage. And so the natural fruits of that, if you will, that occur sometime in the future, relate back to that. I think this case is distinguishable because there is no seed, there is no kernel, there is no right. It's all going to be based on future efforts, which occur long after the marriage is over.
Is there a majority and minority rule on the point that you're...
No. It has not been addressed, as far as we could find. This specific issue, it has been alluded to that post-separation efforts related to the husband or the participant should be separated out. That concept is there, but it hasn't been applied in a supplemental retirement income.
Mr. Geddes,
I see my time is up. But go ahead.
You're in your rebuttal time.
Let me just ask this question. I understand your position is that there are two standards that would have to be satisfied. One of them is that the expectancy be a property right. I still haven't heard an articulation of the second standard that you're saying has to be met.
The second standard would have to be that contributions made by a participant spouse after the divorce, post-separation, is marital property under the statute. Thank you.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon, Your Honor. Good afternoon, counsel. May it please the court, my name is Judy Jones, and I represent the appellee in this particular case, Carrie Fannin. As Your Honors have already discussed with my opposing counsel, one of the main issues in this present case is the question about whether or not there is some type of property right given the contingent nature of these SERP benefits. It is our position that these SERP benefits are in fact marital property, and there is nothing pursuant to statute or the precedent in this case that would otherwise exclude those SERP benefits from being considered part of marital property under 13 Delaware Code 1513. Section 1513 of Delaware Code Title 13 clearly enumerates four factors which would exclude certain properties from being part of marital property, and none of those have been articulated or argued by the appellant in this particular case. And the case law is clear that there is a interest in these type of benefits. This court has a long-standing case precedent of actually confirming that pension rights are considered part of marital property, the most recent, of course, being the Forrester decision.
And is that based upon the premise that they are deferred compensation pensions?
Yes, I believe that they very clearly are going to be considered deferred compensation.
And so what is the SERP plan? Is it deferred compensation or something else?
I believe, Your Honor, and we would argue that it is. Under Article 1, the purpose and effective date of the Wilmington Trust Corporation Supplemental Executive Retirement Plan, it clearly states that the purpose of this plan is to provide supplemental retirement benefits to certain senior management officers of the company, and are intended to supplement the benefits provided by the Wilmington Trust Pension Plan. By the very nature of the plan document itself, I think that's what it's intended. If the intention of a regular pension plan is to be considered deferred compensation and the SERP plan document clearly states that it's intended to supplement those very pension retirement plans, then I don't see how it is any other way of being considered deferred compensation in this particular case. It's just limited to certain select senior officials within the corporation.
But it's also absolutely discretionary with the employer.
It is absolutely discretionary, and we would argue, Your Honor, as Your Honor has questioned opposing counsel, if husband loses, wife loses. If he doesn't attain age 55 or leaves the company before he's entitled to these benefits, he doesn't get them, and neither does she. And that's, you know, and same thing, if Mr. Fannin were to some reason be terminated by the company or otherwise lose his entitlements to those benefits simply because the board decides he's not going to be a participant the following year, Mr. Fannin loses, Mrs. Fannin loses, and that's correct.
Do we have to, in order to affirm, define what the term property or property right means?
I don't believe so, Your Honor. I believe that the case law is clear in decisions such as Forrester, in decisions such as Gregg versus Gregg, in decisions such as Kerr versus Kerr, in decisions such as Robert C.S. versus Barbara J.S., that what is an issue is whether or not there is an interest in some type of asset or property, and it is a future interest. I don't think that those cases say it's got to be a property right that somehow will be acquired in the future. I think the language states in those cases that it's a future interest that is not actually reduced yet to possession, but is still considered marital upon contingencies that may occur point in time after the marriage.
What is the term that's used in the statute? What term are we looking at here?
I think the term under 1513 certainly is property.
Property.
However, I believe that this court has expanded the definition of what is considered property.
Is there a definition to expand in that section?
Your Honor, but I think through the case law, the cases that I have just cited, that there has been explanation and clarification by these courts under those line of decisions that clarifies that property doesn't have to be a fixed property right. It can be an interest. And I think by stating that it's a mere expectancy, it is a matter of semantics. I don't think that that's the holding in the line of cases that this court has issued on similar type of situations and similar types of property or assets that are dependent upon a future contingency.
So even if the a payment under the SERP is an expectancy, as has been argued to us, so long as the wife has an interest in that expectancy, that's marital property that can be divided.
I believe so, yes, Your Honor.
If this plan had been adopted, let's say there's the divorces on day one, and pending the ancillary hearing, this plan is adopted, would it be marital property then simply because of the calculation that pulls the marriage, the time during the marriage into it, or is it excluded?
I'm sorry, Your Honor. I'm not sure I understand your question.
Does the fact that the formula calculates or includes years of marriage in it, is mm-hmm. that what makes it marital, part of the marital foundation or marital property, or is it just the timing of the existence of the plan?
I believe, Your Honor, that it is the fact that the interest were earned and acquired in part during the years of the marriage. So I do believe that it is adding to the foundation and that his interest in the plan when he was first made a participant in 1993, I think that's when her marital interest starts to accrue. And so I think it is during the length of the marriage and not when the plan itself is actually formulated.
That issue was not before us in Forrester, is that right? I mean, have we had an issue? Has this court ever pronounced on the issue that is being brought to us today?
Again, Your Honor, I'm not sure I understand your question. I apologize.
The issue here, as I understand it, is whether or not to constitute property, dividable property under 1513.
Correct.
There must be an enforceable right to it.
I don't believe there does need to be an enforceable
right. I understand that. Okay. And you also have argued that the case law establishes that there doesn't have to be an enforceable right in order for, you know, the thing that we're talking about here to constitute property.
Correct.
My question is, case law from which court?
I think that it's case law from this court, Your Honor.
Which case?
I believe Forrester versus Forrester does establish that. I believe the court in Robert C.S. and Barbara J.S., which dealt with non-vesting retirement plans at that point in time, pension benefits, I believe this court has established the precedent that says it doesn't have to be an enforceable right. What we're really talking about is a future interest that's not yet reduced to actual possession. Interestingly, Your Honor, I believe that this court has held in Sayer versus Sayer that the converse isn't necessarily true, that something that a future interest which may be acquired premaritally but comes into possession at the time of the marriage doesn't necessarily exclude it as premarital property. It's still marital, and I think that line of case and that distinction made in Sayer combined with the cases in Forrester and Robert C.S. and Barbara J.S. shows an inclination from this court to further the purposes of the divorce and annulment statute to include property and assets as being part of the marital estate, and letting the statute and the act, which requires the trial court and the family court to then equitably divide those accordingly to the factors that it's required to under the statute, I think that's the inclination and furthers the purposes of the divorce and the annulment statute. And it's for those reasons, I think, that it adds the SERP or makes this SERP even that much stronger of a case to be considered part of marital property.
Well, let me ask you a hypothetical. What would happen if during the course of a marriage, a neighbor gave a deed to the husband with a contingent remainder in the real property, you know, and not a vested remainder, and then the parties got divorced? When it came time to divide their property, what would the family court do with the contingent remainder?
Assuming, Your Honor, that it wasn't a gift that was otherwise excludable under 1513, I believe in that situation that it would still be considered marital property. The Gregg versus Gregg case was very similar, in which the husband in that particular case had an interest in real estate after the life estate that his mother had in this particular property expired. And I think that it would be analogous in the same type of situation.
So what would how would you analyze the lottery ticket hypothetical?
I think, Your Honor, absolutely the lottery ticket would be considered marital property. In that situation, if the lottery ticket did produce benefits and husband would receive the proceeds, then the wife would benefit. If the ticket was worthless and it produced, you know, no funds, then both party loses.
So the husband would have an expectancy? I mean, is that what the lottery ticket would be?
Whether you call it an expectancy or whether you call it a future interest, I think they're essentially one and the same thing.
Well, if you call it an expectancy, then the wife would have an interest in that expectancy, which would trigger the jurisdiction, presumably would trigger the jurisdiction of the family court to divide that.
Absolutely.
And that is, it would equal property for purposes of the statute that could be divided.
Yes, absolutely.
If you call it a future interest, then you have the graceless creature of the wife having an interest in a future interest.
I think the distinction is negligible at best, Your Honor. I think in the lottery ticket example, Clearly, marital funds were going to be used to purchase that ticket, and she has an interest in the future asset that may be produced by the efforts of the marriage. In your example, whether it is the funds that were used to produce or to buy the lottery ticket, or in this particular case, Ms. Fannin's contributions during her marriage and the support of her husband's career.
Now, you distinguished the Barrington case that opposing counsel relies upon as being a case where the parties actually agreed that the benefit plan was a marital asset, and that that case was simply about the manner in which the benefit was to be valued. Why shouldn't the benefit here be valued as it was in Barrington?
I think first and foremost, Your Honor, is I think because the case of Jerry L.C. and Lucille H.C. Has already addressed that issue, that the Cooper formula, as determined by that decision, addressed the arguments that were made in Barrington and that are being made by Mr. Fannin here today. The fact of the matter is there is, I think, a split in the jurisdictions over how to deal with the fact that some pension benefits may be increased after the marriage by the contributions of the participant in the plan, even after the marriage. And I think the decision of Jerry L.C. and Lucille H.C., the Cooper case, in formulating the Cooper decision, addressed those issues. And I think the biggest rationale in that case is that it is a building of the marital foundation. They don't call it climbing the ladder of success, you know, without justification. It's a step-by-step process to get higher and higher and higher. And Ms. Fannin, in this particular case, gave up her own career. She stood by her husband. She helped support his career. And now to say, you know, he's halfway up the ladder or three-fourths of the way up the ladder, and she's not there anymore, he's going to climb the rest of the way, and then that's not going to have any bearing on how he got when he went up the first three-fourths of that? I don't think there's any credit then if you don't use the Cooper formula to the contributions and the sacrifices made during the marriage by wife to assist Mr. Fannin in reaching the levels that he and the benefits that he might ultimately achieve.
So your position is that the formula or the use of a particular division formula is discretionary, and here there's no abuse of discretion?
Correct.
Your opponent says there's no majority-minority rule on the particular issue before us. Do you agree with that?
I do not agree with it, Your Honor. I do believe that this timeline rule and the marital foundation theory in the jurisdictions is actually the majority rule. If there's no further questions, then I see that my time is almost up. I would simply conclude that for the reasons stated here today and in the briefing by Ms. Fannin as part of the appellee, that you affirm the trial court's decision below, and you include the cert benefits as being considered marital property, and the division pursuant to the Cooper formula be affirmed by this court. Thank you.
Thank you.
May it please the court. Let's go back to the lottery example because I had a chance to think about it. It's different, and here's the reason it's different. There are rules, and once you buy that piece of paper, you have a piece of paper that says if your number comes up, you're entitled to win. The problem with the SERP is there are no rules.
Yes, there are.
No, there are rules.
There are. One of the rules happens to be that, you've got to reach a certain age. You've got to be with the company a certain amount of time. And another rule is that the board in its discretion can eliminate the benefit. But that's a rule.
Well, it's an existing rule, but it could be as shifting as sand. In the lottery example, I have an enforceable right. If my number comes up, I can take that piece of paper and say, you owe me money.
Right. And if all of the contingencies in the SERP come to pass, then husband has an enforceable right, too. Isn't that correct?
Exactly. And the same example that I had over here with Justice Ridgely.
But until the contingencies, both in the lottery ticket and the SERP, come to pass, there is no enforceable right.
That is correct. There's no enforceable right, and there's no enforceable right here. And like the example that I had about the life insurance policy, once I die, and if Justice Ridgely has qualified as 62 and a half, then that is an enforceable right. But until that point in time, it is not enforceable. And we have no law.
Your argument is that the enforceability is measured as of the time of the property division.
That is correct.
So it is a heads I win, tails you lose. Wife loses, husband may win. If husband wins, wife doesn't share. If husband loses, wife is going to lose anyway.
Wife doesn't win, unlike the pension situation, which is the Cooper formula. Cooper does not apply to non-pensions. There is no law or no case that says Cooper applies to non-qualified, non-designated, underfunded retirement supplemental plan. That's what this is. This is not a pension. But the reason wife does not win is because this is not based on things that happened during their marriage. Yes. Has he got a position at the starting gate? Has he reached the 62 and a half? Is he entitled to at least participate? Yes, but there is no assurance that he will win, and the only way he will is if he does his job in the last 5 years in a way and the bank continues annually to select him as a participant. That's based on his efforts, not the marital.
Okay, but by that logic, Mr. Geddes, then it would follow, would it not, that if husband owned the lottery ticket, and we won't know what the results of the lottery are until after the divorce and property division proceedings are over, then at the time of the division, all we have is an expectancy, not a property right, and wife can't share in any potential proceeds. That is, you get the same result with the lottery ticket than you do with the SERP, correct?
No, because the only contingency in a lottery situation is whether your number comes up.
But we won't know that.
That is correct.
We won't know that until, hypothetically at least, until all of the family court proceedings are over.
That is correct. Could I make one point because I see my time is up? This plan is created as an incentive to keep highly qualified employees at the bank. If you now subject that to some kind of levy in this argument, you've now, in essence, turned that plan into an incentive to leave the bank and to work somewhere else.
Well, doesn't your opposing counsel referred to the purpose clause of the SERP plan as intended to supplement the pension plan? Now, why doesn't that shift this into the same category as a pension and a deferred compensation, if that's the intent of it?
The intent is because there's no other way to do this without violating ERISA. Otherwise, you'd have to make everyone else participate. This is an attempt to create a special incentive for highly compensated executives so that they will continue their employment with the bank. It's a completely different design and intent. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you both. The court appreciates your arguments. We'll take this matter under advisement. We'll also take a brief recess.